Thank you all for coming. I'm Sharon Hesterly. I'm PPMD's Vice President for Research. And we have a very full agenda. We have a great day yesterday, talking largely about care. We're moving into the section now. Today we'll be talking about research, some of the preclinical research, and also advocacy. And tomorrow, you will have probably noticed from the agenda, we have back-to-back talks about clinical trials that are going on now. So what I'm going to try to do is set the stage and really orient you to all of the different types of therapies that are going on. I know some of you have been here for many years and have followed all of the therapies as they developed, but we also have new families here. We have some newly diagnosed families, and we also just have a lot of new therapeutics in development, too. And that's a good thing. We've been pretty busy, and the pipeline has gotten very, very full. But I think that it also becomes confusing. And so what I'm going to try and do is put all of that in context. So this is going to be a very high-level overview and hopefully set the stage so that when you see these things discussed in detail in later presentations, you can say, oh, yeah, that was one of the anti-inflammatory drugs she mentioned. So that's the idea. And we'll save some time at the end for questions, too. So Stephanie, how do I advance? Oh. Sorry, okay, we're there. So, this is a different screen than I'm looking at. So, at PPMD, we have a pretty broad platform, as a lot of you know. We do fund research, but we also fund advocacy, we fund education, and also what we call infrastructure projects that support the research. And I think it's important to see that we do this broad spectrum because they're all really interrelated. It turns out that you can't separate them. If you have a clinical trial and you don't have good standards of care at all of the trial centers, you get a lot of variability that gets introduced in the trial. So it turns out that care is very important for drug development. And I think if you just fund research, you're actually doing a disservice because ultimately these things are integrated. And so we try to keep this integrated platform. Okay. Again, let's see if I can... There. Okay, so just a few words. A lot of you know this, probably backwards and forwards, but dystrophin plays a very important role in the muscle cell membrane. It sort of holds the inside of the cell together with the outside. And muscle cells are very active cells. They actually physically move. When muscles contract and expand, these cells move and the internal elements of the cells move. So dystrophin acts kind of like a shock absorber, and it connects the inside and the outsides of the cells and helps the cell membrane deal with the stresses of all that movement as muscles are used and exercised. So what happens when you don't have dystrophin is that you get, you know, a lot of things happen, actually. So, you know, some of the immediate effects is you start to get little tears in the membrane. The membranes become more fragile, and a whole cascade of things happen. So basically you have, I can use the cursor, I suppose, here. You have a lot of things that happen due to the loss of dystrophin beyond just the physical connection with the cell membrane. It starts a cascade of things that happen. Calcium comes into the cells. Free radicals are released. You get an inflammatory reaction that becomes chronic, and it's sort of like the muscle stays chronically irritated. There's some signaling functions that are lost when dystrophin is lost, and you have reduced blood flow to the muscle. You eventually get scarring, and you get muscle cell death. So we have a whole cascade of things that happen when you lose dystrophin. And it looks bad, but on the other hand, you could say, okay, these things are all targets. They're all individual targets for therapy development. And so that's kind of what I'm going to talk to you about today, is anything we can target to try to fix in this whole cascade. At this point, we pretty much have a drug in development to address it. And some of these drugs might be able to be used together as a cocktail. So, and this just shows you... The dystrophin is gone. So this is the sort of key diagram. This is complicated, but I wanted to put it up here because we're going to break it down and we're going to talk about it in little pieces. When we think about how are we going to treat this disease, you can sort of divide things up into these different targets that I mentioned. Probably the easiest thing to think about is right here at the top, you've got dystrophin restoration and replacement. Obviously, Duchenne is caused by the loss of dystrophin due to mutations in the gene. If you can put dystrophin back, then you have treated the root cause of the disease. So things that come into this category that you would have heard of were stop codon read-through, exon skipping, gene therapy, and then what I call functional replacement. There are other proteins that can stand in for dystrophin, like utrophin, that can fulfill that linkage with cell. So that would be a more obvious thing to do. Some of these other things around the rest of the cascade are really sort of... addressing all the things that happened as a consequence of the loss of dystrophin, the inflammation and fibrosis, calcium coming into the cell, loss of muscle mass, increasing blood flow. So we'll break all of this down and kind of talk about it individually. So when we talk about dystrophin restoration and replacement, as I mentioned, you know, this, the primary problem is that you lose this linkage with the inside and the outside of the cell. And these are the things that you can do to address it. So what I've done is broken this down. If you look at exon skipping, what I'm going to do is just give you a quick glimpse. I'm not going to explain exon skipping to you. You're going to hear multiple talks throughout the day on exon skipping, and you will get that information. What I wanted to do is just give you a high-level overview of who's doing what. We have three companies here that are all here at the meeting working on exon skipping, GSK, Sarepta, and Prosensa. And these are the exons they have in development. And what I haven't listed here, but you may get out of these other talks, are which deletions would be suitable for skipping each of these exons. So again, I'm not going to go into the detail because I'm not going to have time. This is a short talk. And so if exon skipping sounds like a foreign language to you, you will understand it better as the rest of the talks unfold today. Another type of strategy is stop codon read-through. Again, this is something to replace dystrophin when you have a tiny mutation in the gene that introduces what we call a premature stop. So the cell, instead of making the whole gene, stops halfway through. There are stop codon read-through drugs that can trigger the cell to ignore that little mutation and actually just go ahead and make the protein anyway. It'll stick in one wrong amino acid sometimes, but it's pretty functional. PTC Therapeutics and Adalern are probably the ones you've heard about the most. They're currently going into a phase 3. And Carmen Bertoni at UCLA has an experimental drug that also does stop codon read-through. And gene therapy. Another way to replace the function of dystrophin is just to put back a healthy copy of the gene. In this case, we call it a mini-dystrophin gene because usually these things are added in viral carriers, viruses that have been disabled. They sort of hollow them out. They pull out the viral genes, and you put in the healthy gene, in this case, dystrophin. Dystrophin is the biggest gene in the human genome. It's actually huge, and it won't fit very well inside the viral carrier. So years of experimentation have allowed investigators to figure out how to miniaturize that gene, just take out pieces of it that aren't necessary for the function. And it'll fit in a viral carrier, and then you can inject that into the muscle, and the viruses go into the cells, and they release the gene, the healthy copy of dystrophin, and the cells can use that healthy copy to make a normal dystrophin protein. In this case, it'll be slightly shorter, but still functional. So we have multiple groups that are working on mini-dystrophin gene therapy, and I think you'll hear a lot more about gene therapy in the coming days, or the coming, you know, years, actually. We sort of heard a lot about it about 15 years ago, and then it got really quiet, but I think that's because there was a lot of this back to the drawing board, and now we're back in the clinic again. And so I think we will see a mini-dystrophin gene therapy in the next couple of years. So then the last thing I'll talk about is dystrophin functional replacement, utrophin upregulation. Utrophin is a sister molecule to dystrophin. It's a lot like dystrophin, but it normally gets turned off after fetal development. And people have been looking at ways to stimulate this drug to turn it back on or turn it back up so that we make more utrophin, and it can actually stand in for the function of dystrophin. So Summit PLC is one of the companies that's planning a trial in Duchenne with a small drug that upregulates utrophin. You know, at PPMD, we've funded other projects. Teji Khurana at University of Pennsylvania has been screening approved drugs to look for drugs that will upregulate utrophin, and he has candidates. We're also going to talk about some, you'll hear from Paul Martin later from Nationwide Children's, who has, he's looking at a gene therapy to upregulate an enzyme that actually doesn't replace the function of dystrophin exactly, but it strengthens that linkage at the cell membrane that's weakened with the loss of dystrophin, so it can sort of stand in for the function. The same thing with agarin and laminin-111. These are other proteins that, if you upregulate them, can strengthen that cell membrane. And there are people working on all of those as well. And then some of you saw, I've got right here at the bottom a little, which you may not be able to see from where you are, but a little thing that's sort of snatched from the headlines. Recently, an investigator at Duke University published some work looking at something he calls gene editing, where instead of putting in a different copy of the gene, you're actually going into the chromosomal DNA and fixing mutations at that level. So we've been looking at that technology for a long time. There have been a lot of iterations of it. To date, it hasn't been very efficient, but eventually we will figure that out, and that would be sort of the ultimate solution, is if you could correct the DNA in the chromosome. And in theory, that would be heritable. It would just be fixed and done and gone. So that's a real goal for the future. So these are all the ways that you could sort of manipulate dystrophin directly, and you will hear from all of these investigators that I've mentioned. You'll hear about all of this in greater detail as we go through the presentations. So I'll mention inflammation and fibrosis very briefly. You know, there's a part of the downstream cascade. The consequence of losing dystrophin is you get sort of a chronically irritated muscle, and you get immune cells that infiltrate the muscle, and this chronic inflammation can cause a lot of damage in and of itself. It becomes unhelpful over time. So, you know, most of your kids either take or you've considered taking steroids. And one of the things steroids do, we think, is sort of tamp down this inflammation, this inflammatory process. And obviously, corticosteroids are not a great thing. We like what they do for preserving walking and ambulation, but the side effects, we all know, are horrendous. So a lot of investigators have been looking at ways to separate those. Is there some way we can get the beneficial effects of steroids but lose the side effects? And the good news is it looks like those are different pathways that are activated by corticosteroids, and that you could probably design a drug that would just hit the positive anti-inflammatory effects without stimulating all those side effects. So we'll talk about those in a minute. And the other thing is, as you lose cells, you also get a process where you build up fibrotic tissue, which is like scar tissue or fatty tissue in the muscle. And that's one of the things people use magnetic resonance imaging to look at the muscle and actually gauge how much of that fatty scar tissue has been built up. So a drug that would prevent that or reverse some of that scarring would also be useful. So there are people working on all these strategies. You will hear from both Katabasis and Reverigen. These are both companies that have drugs that are designed to be steroid replacements. So all the benefits without the side effects, it sounds almost too good to be true. But these are drugs that have a lot of potential, and also a small peptide that Dennis Guttridge at Ohio State is developing to do the same thing. You'll also hear from Halo Therapeutics, who have just launched a clinical trial for Duchenne, and they have a drug that might help with both fibrosis and inflammation and maybe even muscle regeneration that might help with multiple pathways. So you'll hear more about that later in the conference. Increasing muscle mass and strength. So what I've tried to illustrate in the diagram here is even as you lose muscle mass, because you know, you've got this continual cell injury and cell death process going on because you've lost dystrophin, if you can just ramp up the muscle regeneration process, the repair mechanisms, you might be able to stay ahead of the curve. And so if you think about it, if you work out and you get very sore, the reason you're sore partly is because you've done some muscle damage, and that stimulates muscle repair, and you go through that process and you start to bulk up your muscle. That's what happens typically. In Duchenne, what's happening is you're losing muscle mass too fast for the repair mechanism to keep up. So can we boost the repair side and just stay ahead of the curve? You still will have the underlying dystrophin defect, but maybe you can compensate for it. So drugs that do that you'll hear about later at the conference are things that inhibit it. There's a pathway with a molecule called myostatin. Myostatin normally puts the brakes on drug development. But if you don't have myostatin, you get very big muscles. And we know this both from animals who are naturally, you know, have naturally occurring mutations, and even one published paper on a human who had a myostatin mutation that was documented. And these are very muscular, very, very muscular people. So if you block myostatin, you get increased muscle mass. And we know this from animal studies that really does improve muscle mass. And importantly, it seems to improve muscle strength as well, because you wouldn't just want to get bulky and not also get the strength. So other pathways, the Shire Acceleron drug that's been discontinued was another one that hit that pathway. It actually hit a broader pathway than just myostatin. IGF-1 is a growth hormone that, again, increases muscle mass and hopefully strength. That was being tested at Cincinnati. And then the other thing you can look at is WNT7A is a small molecule that actually stimulates the satellite cells in muscles. And the satellite cells are the cells that replenish muscle cells. They're sort of immature, little round baby cells that when they're stimulated will merge with the muscle and increase its bulk. So WNT7A is a drug that Fate Therapeutics is looking at to increase muscle mass. And another drug in this pathway is follistatin. Follistatin can also stimulate muscle mass. And Jerry Mendell at Nationwide Children's is currently doing a gene therapy trial in Becker muscular dystrophy where he's injecting a virus that contains the follistatin gene into muscle. And follistatin is interesting because it doesn't just sit in the cell, it gets secreted. So he's basically turning all of the muscle cells in the quad muscle into little follistatin factories. And then the follistatin in turn helps the muscle increase bulk up. And we hope also, and maybe Jerry will show us, some functional improvements. So you'll hear more about all of these possibilities. A little bit about stem cells as well. So stem cells are another way to increase muscle mass. You can get stem cells, there are sort of, you could divide them into sort of controversial and non-controversial sources. In the world of muscular dystrophy, people aren't actually looking very much at embryonic stem cells, and I think it's because they haven't needed to. You can derive cells from the muscle itself, from the linings of the blood vessel, or from fat, or even take a skin sample and actually sort of deprogram those cells and recreate them as cells that can be turned into muscle cells. So there are a lot of ways to get these cells from adult-derived cells and a lot of sources that people are looking at. A really intriguing idea is to be able to get cells from someone with Duchenne and then modify them outside the body, maybe in the petri dish, by adding back a healthy copy of dystrophin. And the advantage is you're using someone's own cells, so you don't have a problem with an immune rejection. But you do have to correct it and put dystrophin back. And then the idea is if you could put these cells into the bloodstream and get them to go out and migrate into muscle and then build new healthy muscle, you could gradually replace all of the muscle that doesn't have dystrophin, because those cells eventually will die, with these healthy cells that should not die and should have an advantage and should have established. That sounds like a great scenario for actually rebuilding muscle, and we're making progress there as well. I think stem cell research is another thing that got a little bit hyped and lagged behind people's expectations, but it will eventually catch up, and it's starting to catch up. So, for example, we're funding Rita Perlingero at University of Minnesota, who is doing exactly this technique of taking the cells, modifying them outside the body, and then is going to put them back. And she's really working to make sure that all of her approaches are going to be compatible with what the FDA wants to see with a product like this. So hopefully next year we'll be hearing data from that project, and it will have advanced quite a bit. Something else we all know is important is protecting the heart in Duchenne. The heart is a muscle, and dystrophin plays a role in the heart just like it does in skeletal muscle. So we really have to look at not just preserving the skeletal muscle, but also the heart muscle. There's some traditional ways to do this. We've looked at ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. One of the questions has been, if you start those drugs earlier, before you have symptoms, do you get a better effect? And there's a little bit of data, but not a lot. And so I think the jury is out on that, and I'm sure a lot of you have had these long discussions with your cardiologist about whether it makes sense to start the drugs early, but I think that's an important question we need to answer. We looked at other drugs. There are a whole host of these drugs that are ostensibly cardiac drugs, but might actually also have benefits in the skeletal muscle. Losartan is one of those. Eplerenone is another one. It's in a category of cardiac drugs called an aldosterone antagonist. And there's an ongoing clinical trial now that PPMD is sponsoring at Nationwide Children's and Cincinnati Children's Medical Center to look at the effects of eplerenone. They're mostly concentrating on the cardiac effects, but that's another drug that we have reason to believe, if you start it early, might have some beneficial effects on the skeletal muscle as well. So I think as we learn more about it, we're going to start teasing out some of those questions. So the nice thing is it's not all fancy drugs or gene therapy or stem cells therapy. We've got some drugs that are already approved now that if we figure out how to use them appropriately might have a significant difference for your children. So those are what we call the low-hanging fruit. They're already approved. We just need to figure out how to use them appropriately. If we go back to the pie-in-the-sky strategies, there's some other really good targets for cardiac therapy. One is a channel called CIRCA2A that has long been a lot of drug companies have looked at this. We know that you can modify this channel and really have a benefit in cardiomyopathy. It was considered largely undruggable by a lot of drug companies because it was just small molecules just don't seem to affect this target. But we've got Dongxing Duan, who's here at the meeting. He's not speaking. He's here to review grants for me, for which I very much appreciate. But if you snag him, if you're interested, he'll tell you about his work to do gene therapy to deliver the gene for CIRCA2A to the heart. And then PTC Therapeutics has managed to invent a small molecule, or to discover a small molecule that might actually modulate CIRCA2A. So they're working on these. And interestingly, CIRCA2A is important in Duchenne because of the cardiomyopathy, but it's probably important in any form of heart disease. So this is one of those places where rare disease and common disease intersect, and there might be a very good economic motivation to get these drugs developed. And that's fine with us as long as they're willing to test them in Duchenne first. And then some more exotic approaches, like a membrane sealant, an inert polymer that actually just called poloxamer or carmosil that actually sits in the membrane and in theory seals damage in those. So that's being tested by Frix's Pharmaceuticals. Another thing you'll hear about is increasing blood flow to the muscle. So I kind of mentioned casually that one of the downstream effects of losing dystrophin is that dystrophin normally has mostly structural functions in serving as a shock absorber, but it also does some signaling as well. And one part of the signaling that it does is it stimulates a little gas called nitric oxide to come to the cell surface. And nitric oxide, in turn, is a messenger that stimulates blood vessels to stay open during a contraction. So what happens normally, if you think about contracting a muscle, you squeeze everything tight in that muscle when it contracts, and it'll squeeze the blood vessels and the capillaries closed if you don't have some signal telling them you've got to stay open. And that's what this nitric oxide signal normally does, so that when you contract the muscle, it actually actively tells those blood vessels to stay open so that you're getting blood and oxygen to the muscle. Because it's contracting, when you're exercising, that's when you really need that. And so we think, we do have evidence from Ron Victor's work at Cedars-Sinai that you that blood flow is impaired in the muscle in people with Duchenne or Becker. And what could be happening is that on top of the damage you get from losing dystrophin and these little micro tears, you might also be getting a little bit of ischemia, and that's damage caused by lack of oxygen. And the good news is, again, there are drugs that will address this. So we all know the class of drugs for Cialis and Viagra, and we know what they were developed. They were actually not originally developed for erectile dysfunction. They were actually developed for heart disease, and that was an interesting side effect that actually became the main point of those drugs. But one of the things they do really well is hold blood vessels open against a contraction. So we have two. You'll hear from Catherine Wagner at Kennedy Krieger, who will talk about a sildenafil trial. The drug was called Revatio. That was in older men with Duchenne, or older boys and men. And then Ron Victor will talk about work with tadalafil or Cialis. And so I think those work is, again, another example of a drug that's already approved, and if we figure out how to use it, might be really helpful. It's not going to be the whole answer. It's not going to be a cure for the disease, but it might be something that added to other therapies helps incrementally. And when we add these things together, you end up with a significant result. Managing intracellular calcium is just another approach. We know that when you get these micro tears in the membrane of a muscle cell, one of the things that happens is that calcium floods into the cell, and calcium just gets dysregulated in the cell. And it's normally very, very tightly controlled. Calcium is a signaling messenger. We think of calcium in terms of healthy bones and what it does for us, and it's always good, right? You think muscle, calcium. But within the cell itself, calcium is a very important signal, highly regulated. So when you get calcium flooding into the cells, or the ways that it's controlled intracellularly get damaged, you end up with a lot of damage. You get free radical damage, and it will eventually kill the cell. It doesn't mean you can control anything by restricting dietary calcium. That makes no difference. So it's not that kind of thing. But there are channels in the muscle cell membrane that are calcium sensitive or control calcium. And there are a couple of approaches, companies that are looking at ways of managing these channels. So even though you're getting these micro tears, can we manage that calcium that's flooding into the cell? And two of those are Rycol, which is one drug that's in development that deals with intracellular calcium. And then there's another small, you probably have heard, a lot of you have heard about this tarantula venom, because it's hard to forget that image. So I put it on the slide just in case you didn't have the image in your head of a spider. But there's a component of tarantula venom that might actually control a pore that's important on the outside of the cell and might be relevant to Duchenne. And it's Tanis Therapeutics that's working on that work. So that was a good overview. You're going to hear more about all of these things, and I wanted to just give you a snapshot. So what is PPMD funding? How many of these different strategies? And you can see, you probably can't see the detail, but you can see from my slide that we have a very balanced portfolio. We want to make sure that we are funding a lot of different things. We don't know what's going to be successful, and we also think it's likely going to require a cocktail of drugs to treat the disease, so we want to make sure that our expenditures are spread out pretty well. If you want detail about what we're funding, you can find that information on our website, actually, under the red tab that says Research. If you go to What We Are Funding, we have all of our grants listed there. You can click on those grants and get more detail about them. Here I've just taken a second to plug Stan Nelson's study at UCLA. So he's working on a study to identify genetic modifiers for Duchenne. So these would be genes that aren't dystrophin but still have some effect, positive or negative, on the disease. It might explain some of the variability you see, and sometimes boys with even very similar mutations, someone will progress faster or slower. So he's trying to understand what creates these outliers. You know, boys who look like they have classic Duchenne because they're not making any dystrophin, but they're either doing very well or they're doing not as well as expected. And these genes become targets. If you find a genetic modifier that seems to make, you know, modify the results of the disease and make it milder, is there any way we can stimulate that? I mean, anything we can learn about a pathway like that is new information. It becomes another target for drug development. So the gist of that is, if you're interested in participating in the study, you can get that information from the Duchenne Connect website, and I'm sure Stan Nelson would very much appreciate it. A few words about how we fund research. We have a scientific advisory committee. A lot of the names you see on this list will be speakers later today. And we also have a drug development advisory committee. And these groups work together to review projects. People write grant applications. We meet. We try to have at least two written reviews from reviewers. And then they come together and they discuss them. And we're actually doing that tonight while we're here later. We'll be reviewing grants here to decide what to fund next. But we have very constructive discussions, and I think one of the things that I find is really useful in these reviews is it's not always just a yes or no answer. Sometimes this is a really good grant, but there's one piece of it that would make it stronger. And we can go back to the, you know, to the applicant and say, we're interested in funding this, but we need you to add this or change this or do something that everybody agrees is going to make it a stronger project. And so I think that's another benefit of peer review people don't think about. It's not always just a yes or no decision. It's all of that feedback, that sort of group think, so that it's not just you in your own lab just looking at your own problem. You get some outside input. We also work with TrueDNMD. This is a European-funded group that does a lot of things, and you can kind of see some of their different activities. But one of the things they do is they also run the TACT, which is the TrueDNMD. I'm going to forget what it stands for. I'm bad with acronyms. But they do drug development. So it's a group of experts who come together on a volunteer basis, and these are people with backgrounds in drug development. And see, I'm doing on time. I'm actually – okay, so we were ahead, and now we're behind. So I'm going to wrap it up in just a second. But the point is that this is a very sophisticated group with a lot of talents. They come together and they review these drug development projects and generate a written report that's pretty detailed. And PPMD has been helping fund these review committee meetings. And then we use the results of these meetings to help us in our funding decisions as well. Because as you saw, there's a lot of work going on out there. We can't fund all of it. And later today, we're actually going to do an exercise that I hope works well, where we let you all participate in a drug application review. And you will get to vote and listen to the discussion and decide what you think should be funded and what shouldn't. And I'll mention these are going to be hypothetical projects, but I want you to get the flavor of how that works. So a little bit about TACT, but I'm going to skim through it. I was going to talk a little bit about drug development, just to lay the groundwork for some of the things we fund other than research. We also fund infrastructure. These are things that support drug development. I'm showing you now the stages of drug development. It's a long process. There's a lot that goes into it. You can fund things at all these different stages. A lot of our funding would come in sort of at this stage, when a company is being founded, or right before it, when the money is being, or the data is being generated to go into a trial. By the time you get into a phase two or phase three trial, you really need a lot of money. The cost of developing a new drug is estimated at $1.3 billion right now. Obviously, at this end, what we want is investors and companies, pharmaceutical companies that have that kind of money to bring this drug all the way to the market. We fund here to make it look attractive to those companies later on. Finally, another thing we look at is the Duchenne Drug Development Report Card. These are sort of all of the tools and things that need to be in place to do effective drug development. The U actually stands for underway. I think when I was growing up on my report card, it meant something negative because I can still imagine some for handwriting and conduct. In this case, it's underway. So I think we've got a good grip on what we need to do, and everything that we haven't completed is well in the works to be able to do drug development. The title of the talk was Better, Faster, Now. We have a detailed strategy on our website that explains how we fund things in this category with these aims. Again, I won't go into it in detail because, okay, I am on time. I don't want to get into the next session. But we do try to look at things that we can fund that will make clinical trials happen more quickly and more efficiently. If we can reduce that $1.3 billion any way we can, we like to try to do that. Provide incentives, lower the entry bar for companies that want to get involved. We want to fund really good drug candidates. There's probably some drug candidates that shouldn't go into testing, and when they do, they use resources and, you know, patients. And when I say use patients, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that you've got boys who could be participating in a trial with an effective drug who might get sidetracked into a trial with a less effective drug. So we see a lot of opportunity costs, both financial and human, when that happens. And finally, we are also focusing, like I said, on these drugs that are already approved, the low-hanging fruit. That's the now side of my talk, is what can we do now that's not going to take a six-year development pathway. This is a highway that's meant to illustrate, you know, you can build a good drug, a fancy race car, but if you don't have the road, you're not going anywhere. And some of the things that we've looked at doing include building networks of sites that are really trial ready in a way that industry can use and just sort of be plug and play, whether it's master site agreement so that all the trials have agreed to the same type of agreement. And some of you have probably heard the talk from DART Therapeutics about their superhighway plan and might notice that these sound very similar. And we noticed that as well. We said, you know, I think we're talking about the same thing. So we haven't announced it formally yet, but we have signed an agreement to help DART support the superhighway project that they're planning, which is to pull together this network of clinical trial sites that can do very sophisticated drug development. So again, it's another one of these things of if we're talking about the same thing, let's not reinvent the wheel. So we agreed to collaborate with them, and we're going to move forward with that, and you'll be hearing more about it in the next several weeks. So that's all of my talk. I'll save a little time for questions. And if we finish early, that's good, too, because at some point we'll get behind, and we're really fighting that. So I'll finish up, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. If I've just stunned everyone, too much science, too fast. Yeah, so...